The views and opinions expressed are those of the hosts, our callers, and guests, and do not necessarily represent those of the society, its management, or our advertisers. We hope you enjoy this week's episode.
Welcome to Sam Sense, the show that dives deep into the fascinating world of management. I'm one of your hosts, Allie, and I'm thrilled to have you join us on this journey of exploration and discovery. In each episode, we'll unravel complexities, share thought-provoking insights, and engage in captivating conversations with experts and enthusiasts in the management realm. This podcast is designed to both educate and entertain. Joined with me today are my co-hosts, Patrick, Hank, and Wesley. Welcome to our podcast.
All right. Welcome to this very special episode of Sam Sense. Remember those when you were a kid? Those very special episodes of like your Sunday, yeah, like
your Sunday cartoons.
Is like a very special episode of Blossom or a very
what the
special
heck is Blossom.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Oh, no.
Oh, God.
Well, that's from the 90s.
Yeah.
Scooby-Doo.
I don't think Scooby-Doo had any very special episodes.
Every episode was special.
In addition to, like, they...
What about the Hex Girls? Come on, that was an extremely special episode.
He has no idea what you're talking about now.
All right.
Like witches?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I know.
Witches. So just for notes, Scooby-Doo has 100 specials at this point. It's like Scooby-Doo and the Wolfman. There's like the whole new series of them where it's like Scooby-Doo and the gang and then they insert a like relevant pop star.
Right, but
or pop culture
but those
star.
Other special episodes all had to do with drugs.
No.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, like
hallucinations.
Come home and like Blossom found cocaine on the street and we're not sure if she's going to actually snort it.
Blossom was never going to snort the cocaine.
Okay, on that
note. Still don't know what Blossom is.
Do you know Sheldon Cooper's wife?
Yeah.
That's Blossom.
Oh.
Okay.
Mayim Bialik.
Yep. Very good, Patrick.
Wow. When I think of Blossom, I think of the Powerpuff Girls, which also ran on Sundays.
It did, with Buttercup and...
Bubbles.
Oh. Bubbles was always so much fun.
I know. She's such a ditz.
As we digress,
slide into the insanity of weekend morning cartoons.
The voice that you've heard that's new is Michelle Gonzalez, who is the CEO and founder of New Frontiers Behavioral Health.
Yes,
and she's here to join us today to help us maybe navigate some workplace situations and to help us with. Maybe some entrepreneurial tips as well. So, Michelle, thank you for joining us.
Oh, so this is going to be clinical consultation as well as business oriented?
Yeah, so I guess we're going to have to.
is
everyone's insurance up to date?
Mine is. I'm good. They just took it out of my account this morning, so we're good.
I'm pretty sure you'd be an out of network provider.
Probably, but
you're not from Rhode Island, that's right.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, the Florida network is probably a little different. So.
Well, maybe in a year it might change.
Who knows? Hopefully.
It could change in 3 days.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
So, thank you for joining us. Could you start with tell us a little bit about your business, how you came to be and what it is that you do?
Yeah, I mean, I've always asked myself, what is health my entire life? Mostly because I had asthma and I was always sick every quarter of the year, probably to get out of school. And I just was like, God, you know, what's going on with this thing? So I got really into physical health, you know, fitness and talking to people like, yeah, it's really easy. You just go to the gym 3 times a week and walk for 20 minutes and lift weights. And people are like,
Really?
I don't think so. So I was like, wow, what's going on here? What's wrong with people? How come they can't change their behavior?
Ooh.
Yeah. And then at the time, I was like, well, you know, we can work from a community perspective. And so I was like, why not jump into public health? And so I went and got a degree in public health and started working for the evil managed care organization, but I was working in employee health and fitness and helping employers to create opportunities within their organization for people to take time to exercise or to eat well or to learn more about how they can improve their health and fitness. And then every time we met, it was always about this personality or this conflict with your manager or, oh, my child is depressed, or like really heavy topics. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was like, oh my goodness, this is, I don't feel comfortable talking about depression or suicidality or anxiety or anger or just do your job, right? And I was like, no. So I went back to school at the ripe age of, well, to say ripe age. And I was like, yeah, this clinical social work sounds wonderful. Let me learn more about it, you know, social justice. But I also started getting more involved in that, which I resisted, which was diagnosing people with certain types of conditions. We'll just say that, right? So a little too much psychopathology, we call it. What's wrong with me? Nothing's wrong with you. We have a diagnosis to help you to cope with it. And at first I resisted it, like I said before, but then I got into it. And slowly but surely, I thought it was going to be more of a manager of like a nonprofit that reached out to people with HIV or people living with chronic conditions, because I really wanted to keep the physical health and the medical health in there. Instead, I started working with people who with severe and persistent mental illness, and that was more of my clinical training. And then went into promoting the integration of primary care, you know, like going to your doctor for like
your annual physical,
or to manage diabetes or to prevent it, and behavioral health, like how they go hand in hand. And so I'm still working in with doctors right now because, you know, the starting of the private practice was more of an offshoot of that. So I wanted to spend more time with patients, be able to approach their care in a way that was about new frontiers rather than, you know, treating something that has to be fixed, which a lot of our healthcare is about, right? Disease management. Sometimes prevention, but mostly disease management, because a lot of the food we eat and the air we breathe and the places we live are killing us. So what do we do about how we think about it or how we feel about it? So the business was started because we now have an opportunity due to the pandemic to treat people online. And I'm sure you've heard it. We can talk about what's going on with the model of behavioral health and mental health and what's the difference. Why did I choose behavioral health over mental health is another question. So that got me thinking, well, I want to work more with more diverse populations, and so let's start this internet-oriented business. So I'm ramping it up because I had a business before that was very, very risky, and I can't risk losing the house, so to speak. So I'm carefully ramping this up. But in my field, we can do a lot of different things. You can contract yourself out. You can do one-on-one. But eventually, I'm aiming to build the business so I have other people working with me under my license so I can train them in this approach, which I'll go into later.
Yeah, no, that's
amazing.
It really is. It sounds great. And one of the things you touched on, like almost immediately, you know, was the difference between mental health and behavioral health. And for our listeners who may not be familiar with that concept, would you mind talking a little bit about the, you know, the difference and where the line is there and what that looks like?
Sure. A lot of what you read in, I don't know, online or what you hear from the government, it sounds interchangeable, you know. But behavioral health is actually how you're thinking and feeling leads to certain actions like substance use, anger, outbursts. So, you know, rather than working on some of the psychological disorders like being bipolar or living with depression or anxiety, we're really looking at how certain behaviors affect those conditions. And sometimes some people are living with significant, severe, persistent mental illness like schizophrenia or bipolar, which I hope people don't feel scared about. It's really like the way that they perceive information from the environment and from others is skewed, you know, and they, you know, they either think differently, which leads to certain behaviors, or they react, you know, as if somebody's a threat or something is depressing. Or they have to, like, as in bipolar manic state, do everything all at once every day and get no sleep and do not eat and engage in very risky behaviors like charging their credit card. And then what usually happens after that is they collapse physically. So then we're like, okay, now we can treat you. But it creates a lot of chaos for their families. So that was a little like disease pathology. But yeah, so behavioral health to encompass the whole experience of being a human being. That's really what behavioral health's about. Like, how do I think? How do I feel about how I think, or vice versa? And then what are the behaviors or the habits or actions that I do, which leads to your character? And as a yogi say, your destiny.
I love that. And there were so many pieces there, too, that you brought up that I just really resonate with. I mean, you talked about how, okay, you might be a person who's experiencing this right now, but that doesn't mean that that is who you are. It is just something that you're going through right now. So I really liked that piece of it. But I am curious. I certainly have noticed in my lifetime a change about how we approach these types of issues and, you know, how we, from a societal perspective, how we handle this. I'm curious to know how that evolution, what you have seen and how that's impacted you. And you know, ultimately, it looks like it led you to this new wonderful company, this creation. So, you know, what kind of evolution have you seen? Where are we today versus where we were before? Is, you know, what does that mean for us?
Wow, that's a loaded question. So when you say society, you're saying American society, United States right now?
Generally speaking, yes. That's probably a little bit of a limited thinking there, is kind of my own fault. But
it's our country, our world. I mean, it's fine. Yeah. It's a really good point, because a lot of people are grappling with what is considered appropriate in our country. But in terms of what's happening, our expectations, sure, I mean, like, the evolution is, you know, come to United States of America, you do go to school, get good grades, get a good job, raise a family, hopefully, and pay your bills. Mm-hmm. End of story, right? But that doesn't happen to everybody.
Right.
Some people are struggling in school because the education system is very punitive sometimes and doesn't regard a student individually, but rather as a group. A cohort who are similar, and therefore, if you're a little different, you're considered, okay, you guys, get out your statistics, an outlier, and therefore, who cares? Because we just want to graduate the norm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then there's like, well, I don't have a bachelor's degree or a master's degree, but I'm really, really, I'm a self-taught person. At the turn of the century, self-taught was considered, the last century. Like from the 1700s to the 1800s and the 1800s to the 1900s,
right.
Not the one that just happened 25 years ago. So excited. And either, you know, you were self-taught or you were apprentice or you had mentors, you had people who guided you, and the conversation wasn't of maladies, you know, like your psychopathology. It was more of their character. This is a hardworking person. This is a person who's diligent. This is a person who has morals, right? Mm-hmm. So morals were considered about character, about how you conducted yourself every single day. And then there came this era of moral reasoning, where morals was about a dilemma between, is this right or is this wrong?
Yeah.
Well, what are your values? What's your virtue? Even that word virtue doesn't mean chastity. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's just like, what is your virtue? That was a big thing at the, you know, between 1800s and 1900s. And then you had all these wars. And so we still had that story of, you know, if you work hard in the United States, you'll do well. And people are realizing that's not happening.
And speaking to it not happening, I really wanted to take it towards management now and talk about what we're seeing inside of the workplace.
Ooh.
You know, because you're absolutely correct. Like, there's been this evolution now towards what I perceive to be acceptance, right? Or at least a desire to reach out and be vulnerable and accept help and, you know, have these types of conversations. And I think that that's really important for how we address these types of concerns inside the workplace, not only from an individual level, but from an organizational level as well. Perhaps I think that might have been where your head was going, Patrick.
I think it's kind of in that I was working my way towards there, but you said something that just kind of popped into my head and something that I was like, that's an interesting way to phrase that. When you're talking about during the turn of the last century, it was about, you know, morals and what were your driving, you know, principles and how did you apply your personal brand of ethics to whatever it was, that whether it was your workplace or if it was your relationship and your family and those things.
And the church too.
Oh, and you know, for a substantial period of time, memoriam, your community was usually revolved around some kind of faith-based organization. And that organization had a moral code that they were trying to translate and pass on to the masses of the people who were members of that organization. Mm-hmm. But we've kind of seen a lot of drift that comes from that. And it's a thing that I think I have seen in hiring processes and things like that. When you start to talk to people about what are your, you know, what are your morals? What are your ethics? Where are your virtues? What do you find important in your life? That 20 years ago, it was, that's an interesting answer. Now you could sit across the room from a recent graduate of high school and ask them about, you know, what decisions created a moral code in their life, or what kind of ethics that they use to apply to a situation. Because that's a lot of interviews are now based on, here's a scenario, tell me what you would do. Mm-hmm. And then the scenario is something, the question is designed to elicit, we want to see if your workplace ethic and morals are compatible with the system that we currently have. And then are they going to raise the standards inside the office and make the place a better place to work that's more productive and in a better, you know, alignment with the company's mission or values? Or are you going to be a detriment to it? Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, when you ask them those questions that are connected to those things, it's just a random question. And they're like, oh my God, I'm stumped. Mm. Because I feel like younger generations have been put at a disservice where we're talking about having tools to help them define their morals and ethics. And we don't talk about that in the standard education practice. They're not getting it from their community-based resources with their family. You know, in some cases, both of your parents work. Maybe you don't have both parents and one parent works two jobs, or like there's a whole generation. I know we're just spiraling out of control here.
Oh, yeah, complexities of our society.
There's a lot of complex pieces to it. But what I think, at least from my perspective, what I see is that we have challenges in the younger generations of people entering into the workforce and society being able to even identify what their own morals are. Mm. Like where is your line? And then how do you connect those things? And I guess to kind of bring that back into that, the workplace is a place where you have to have those things. And so people who go into workplaces and they struggle with, you know, they weren't taught that, they don't have that methodology of thinking, because there are a lot of people who, you know, winged it through their childhood and, you know, they're excited that they made it, but they're sort of been placed at a disadvantage. So to kind of then connect that to what you were saying, Wesley, like how companies are realizing that they're having to put some of those pieces in their own support structure. So are you seeing that from the behavioral health side of it, where companies are trying to integrate more of those services into their, support structure for their employees?
I don't know if they're integrating it so much into, I mean, it's still compartmentalized. I mean, the reason I got into behavioral health was because everybody's going to have some sort of adjustment to change. Mm-hmm. And that's when you kind of like hate to say this, but the fork in the road, like, which way am I going to go with this? And the basic question I always ask is, you know, what do you value? Mm-hmm. What do you care about? What matters to you? And you usually get the stock order family, being honest. But sometimes people just say, you're right, I don't know. And so it's an exploration. The second thing is, everyone's been affected by the people around them, how they grew up, and their culture, either of the neighborhood or of origin. I mean, there's always a culture no matter where you go. You go into the coffee shop, there's a culture. You come into New England Tech, there's a culture here, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I look around, I'm like, ooh, what a sterile environment. But it's so pretty with the fishes. And then going to my clinic, which is, family care, and I'm sitting in a linoleum room with like an exam table. It's like, ooh. But you know, how do I make it something that's like, okay, let's have a conversation here. So there's always culture with your environment. Mm-hmm. And to get to your question, sometimes it's with organizations, they try to make it compartmentalized. Okay, here we're going to have our health promotion program. We're going to bring in somebody. And when I was getting, doing workshops for Optum Healthcare, we were doing more mental healthy ones, listen to me. And it was more about like how to work with supervisors around substance abuse, how to learn more about suicidality, you know, those really heavy topics. And mm-hmm. I think one of the hardest one I did was how to work with difficult people.
Ooh.
Okay, yeah. And so they're learning skills. So even though if you come in and you're fresh and unconscious of how your values are, when you start to engage with people, other people, this is what we all forget, mm-hmm. there's always conflict.
Mm-hmm. There is.
There is. Everyone's got their own agenda. In fact, I thought about it today. Hank said to me, don't prepare. You'll be fine. I'm like, oh, yeah. Because I listen. You know, which has taken me a long time because I used to react to like, oh, my God, that person's going to think I'm lazy, or, oh, my God, I made a mistake. I'm doomed forever, you know. And so in some ways, a lot of employers do want, you know, are their employees to be on edge, to be worried.
Yeah.
But others find that when you're relaxed and comfortable, you're more likely to produce.
Yeah.
So, and that's where the idea of accepting and being vulnerable comes.
So I am going to loop back to something you said earlier. There's that difference between mental health and behavioral health. So in your opinion, do you think like this corporate world who's advocating mental health in the workplace is kind of branding it incorrectly and it should really be behavioral health in the workplace rather than mental health? What's your stance there?
Well, I think they're starting out with mental health because they really want to address what we clinically call disorders, according to the DSM-5 TR now, where psychologists got together and psychiatrists and they tried to identify certain conditions and symptoms, right? We're just looking at symptoms to help people cope with, you know, like this way of maladapting to their stressors. Let's just call it that. And sometimes it's disorders that are about adjusting. So what they're trying to do is trying to understand, like, okay, this way of thinking, this way of feeling, and then even these actions, like overwashing your hands because, or checking the doorknobs every night before you go to bed, is getting in the way of somebody's life. Mm-hmm. Okay, so think of a disorder as taking up this entire room. It's all you can think about.
Mm-hmm.
You can't think about lunch. You can't think about maybe, well, where do I want to be in 5 years? And so it's distressing to the person. Mm-hmm. It's disruptive to their life. And in some instances, it can be dangerous mm-hmm. to themselves or others. So that's how we classify it. But it's distressing to the human being
yeah.
or to their family. So that's part of it. But behavioral health, it goes back and forth. I mean, they're using it interchangeably, Allie, I think.
Yeah.
But right now, I think a lot of people are wondering, well, what is this thing called anxiety? What is this thing called depression?
Yeah.
You know, and how do I get rid of it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you mentioned, and I love that this is kind of where the conversation brought us, but just a few minutes ago, you mentioned one of the things that you were working with was how to handle difficulty in the workplace, how to handle
conflicts,
other personalities. And I'm really curious for our listeners, what kind of advice would you have for them? Like, you know, what it does, obviously, you know, we don't have an hour long, presentation session here with you. I wish we did, but from a very high level, what kind of tips do you have?
Yeah.
For us?
Tell me how I can work better with Allie.
Be patient. I've always been a systems thinker. I've always been thinking about, like, you know, what's the funnel here? And then how do I make meaning of it? And so I guess in a nutshell, we do a lot of therapies on people, which really helps. It goes to this therapy that Laura Linnen came out with for people who have borderline personality disorder. So sorry, people. Which is, you know, that personality disorder comes from a very disruptive, invalidating environment. Mm-hmm. It's like, but it works for a lot of people, you know. And the first thing is to have effective interpersonal skills. Mm-hmm. You know, interpersonal. I would say, I got interpersonal skills. I'm right. You're wrong. And it's like, no, let's be effective, right? And then the second, and then a part of that as a nutshell is like, well, how do I develop that? How do I do that? And it goes through everything that you've been taught about, which is basically having to use your frontal lobe more. Our first reaction is always going to be emotional. And when I said frontal lobe, folks, I meant the front of your forehead, which takes about until 25 to be fully developed. That's why you don't want to use substances as a teenager, because your brain is mushy, still developing.
Yeah. I
have three other modalities too, but go ahead, Patrick.
I'll hold off and I'll round back around. But there's something in there that you said about, you know, the interpersonal relationship part, mm-hmm. yeah. that I think we're seeing people that don't have an ability to form interpersonal relationships because they have not seen that modeled.
Oh, very good.
And
yep. very good. Yep.
Workplaces are built on connections and relationships between subordinates and employers, employees and customers and, you know, the whole chain of things are all linked together. And when people miss out on the skill of interpersonal relationships, it causes a lot of chaos because workplaces Absolutely. Are not set up to not handle, like, there are very few places in the world where you can hold a job and have no interpersonal skills.
Right. It's a constant work in progress. It has to be. And people have got to stop being lazy about how they get along with each other. Yes. Unfortunately, our current environment is showing a very aggressive communication styles. So it's communication, right? So there's three styles. Passive-aggressive. Yeah, sure, go ahead. I hate you. Aggressive, which is my way or the highway, which you see in healthcare. I mean, it's not just doctors. I have some nurses who have been around for 30 years, and they're extremely aggressive, like even to their manager, and that happened to me once. Mm-hmm. And I was, because they just can't let go. They can't let go of their thought.
Yeah.
They can't consider another person's environment. And then really what we all want to develop more is assertive communication. You know, here's how I look at it. How do you look at it? And we don't practice that. Because why? Because we think everything's a sports game, a zero-sum game. We've got to look at conflict as a win-win situation.
Yes.
And here's why it's beneficial for you people out there who really like to play the game and like to dominate. It's because you want to stop being an animal. You want to be more of a human being. Mm-hmm. Everyone's acting like, you know, I don't know, lions going around pissing on their territory.
It makes me think of the Mean Girls scene where they just like change it into all the animals from Africa.
They did? Oh God, I gotta see that.
It's good. It's a good one.
All right, sorry, derailed a little
bit. And you know, and sometimes in some ways it makes sense, but there's, you know, it's like what President Obama once said. He said to somebody who disagreed with him, you gotta do what you gotta do and I gotta do what I gotta do. Mm-hmm. But he didn't need to dominate that person. And so you're right, we each have our own agendas, but there are some things that are right. And for behavioral health, it's like, how can this person adapt to a very difficult situation, you know, in a mm-hmm. way that's approaching rather than avoiding?
Right.
But following up on that, one of the things about interpersonal relationships, right, letting something go, right? Because you mentioned the nurse, right, who couldn't let that thing go for whatever reason it was. Obviously, you know, in her mind, 100% right, you were 100% wrong.
Right.
How do you work with somebody like that? Like, how do you break through that, like, you know, because, I mean, a lot of times, you know, we call it pigeonholing. You know, mm-hmm. you know, your manager thinks you're X, and that's what you're going to be. And how do you change perceptions? How do you get that person from being obstinate to cooperative?
Oh my gosh! So realize,
just solve all the world's problems. There you go.
Just realize that if you're the person who's receiving that I'm right, you're wrong, you're going to have to do the second thing, which is being able to regulate or control your emotions, because you're going to want to punch that person in the face right away, okay? So I want you to turn the mirror towards this person and just say, that person's got a problem. And then give them my phone number and work with them. No, but seriously, you have to take a break then. It's just, it's going nowhere. It's stalemated, you know, and it gets personal too. At that time, I was able to pull out the manager card and say, if you say one more word to me, I'm going to write you up. So I had to be aggressive with this person. I had to leave. I mean, you might have to. You might say, you know what, we're not going anywhere with this conversation. I'm going to leave. And you have to cut it off.
And that kind of ties right into coaching from an employer where they might have an underperforming employee or something like that. And the underperforming employee has the perspective of, I'm the best employee here. How do we, you know?
Or my personality is right. Everybody hates me and I'm.
Yeah, we had a few questions from our listeners regarding that underperforming and coaching, underperforming employees. So what would you say is, what would your approach be? Because we talked about a book approach, but I think that probably...
You mean from a management perspective?
From a management perspective. But I'm just saying you know.
Yeah. Some people aren't going to change. You know, you come into a culture and you're like, okay, this is what our expectations are. Here's what your role is. But there's constant chaos, conflict, disruption in the team. And you know there's a couple of bad eggs in there. Okay, there's somebody who's really got a difficult time dealing with people. And so you put as much structure as you can. You do the corrective action. You say, here's what I expect. But then, you know, you're going to have to send them to the EAP. Because there's something structurally not fitting with this person. And the team and the organization, you have to think about as well as the individual. And a lot of upper echelon people will say, no, give them another chance. No, 3 months. They haven't changed their behavior because they're not a good fit.
So for our listeners here that don't know what an EAP is, it's an employee assistance program that is the majority of the time provided by your employer. So it's 24/7 confidential line, free of charge, where you can talk to a mental health specialist regarding work-related issues, home-related issues, financial issues. There's a plethora of items or issues per se that you can discuss 100% confidential.
And so, if you're a manager, you can mandate an employee to take it.
Yes.
Wow.
Yep.
Thank you for the clarification, too, by the way, because I did not actually know about that.
Sorry about that.
No, thank you.
Insurance world, I present it at meetings all the time. But the sad thing is no one, because...
Stigma.
People don't take it. So a lot of our companies get utilization reports each quarter, monthly, whatever it may be, depending on the size of the group. And 1-2 calls a quarter. And for these hundreds of employee companies.
Yeah, I would be nervous. I mean, I'll be as an employee, if I'm calling the AAP, that's part of the problem with corporate America, right? They'll say
confidential,
either A, it's not really confidential, or B, we really want to know what you think, but they really don't want to know what you think. They want to regurgitate what they've been saying. Yeah. You know,
the good thing with the EAP is it's typically a third party.
Yeah. Oh, no, it is. Yeah. And I think maybe that's why they're doing more mental health awareness, because they want employees to realize that sometimes you can't do it all by yourself. And that's okay to do this and, in fact, normalize it, which I get. And I presented last year at SAM, and one of the things that the American Psychological Association is tracking is our mental health, well-being, stress in the world. And a lot of people didn't access resources because they didn't want to, A, burden somebody, or because they're like, I can handle this on my own, or there's something wrong with me, and I don't want to face that. There's nothing wrong with you. You're adjusting. You're changing. You're evolving.
Yeah.
If you're the same person you were, if you're the same person today as you were 10 years ago, there's something wrong.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. So
except Wesley. We want 10 well, year ago, Wesley.
No, keep the good parts. Keep the good parts.
Wesley, you should get an EAP for your own company.
There you go. I want a hairline from 10 years ago and certainly a waistline from 10 years ago.
Same.
Yeah, and then how do you adjust to those changes, right?
Right.
Inevitable.
A whole new wardrobe.
Pretty much. Now, you had mentioned just a few minutes ago, Michelle, that we were kind of taking the conversation off on a little bit of a tangent there, but you'd said that you had some other, I believe you called them modalities, that you wanted to go into. So I'd love to hear more about those.
Yeah, so we talked about effective interpersonal skills and, you know, some of the actions that people do that don't work. Then we talked about emotional regulation a little bit, you know, like, okay, you're not going to punch that person in the face. Mm-hmm. And you, but acknowledge you're angry and you got to walk away from that conversation instead of fighting it. And that's what I don't see happening. People are escalating their arguments. Mm-hmm. They're getting aggressive, 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 which only leads to more people being hurt. And then the other ones were... distress tolerance. Oh my gosh, we need more of that. That's why your manager asks you to just get up and present, because they're trying to, you know, help you through distress. You have something good to say. Take on those opportunities or those situations that push you. And that's and then how do you practice tolerating that? Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is physical, because your part of your primitive brain reacts to threats, and when we get anxious, we get a physiological, which means, you know, a body reaction. And how do you manage that? How do you deep breathe through it? Some people do squats. Some people talk to themselves, I'm a competent, capable, awesome person. So there's a lot of different things you can do to think and move. And then the last one was mindfulness, which a lot of people like to start with, because it's really easy to do that. It's like, am I tapping my toe? Am I breathing heavily? You know, just taking stock. Did I just tune out for the last 2 minutes? Come back, you know? Mm-hmm. That's what happened to me on the way over here, because I was thinking about a book I want to write. I was like, oh my God, I got the whole outline. And then I was like, whoops, I'm late. Sorry.
So
those are the four things. That's dialectical behavioral therapy. It's amazing.
And I love that.
You don't have to be struggling to go through it.
Yeah.
Everyone needs more mindfulness. In fact, there's so many schools, like Boston University has a mindfulness program for executives. And we're finding that because you're being mindful of your animal nature and how you interact and what is bothering you. Mm-hmm. And then you got to practice your distress tolerance things. This is why, you know, people do the polar plunge. I always wondered why in the world. Why is somebody doing a polar plunge? Why is somebody running the marathon? They're practicing on their distress tolerance. They're like, I'm going to tell my animal nature that I'm going to be okay. I can do this. Yes. And I have a great book for everybody to read, too, by the way.
Is that why I abuse myself by doing half marathons? I'm practicing my distress tolerance.
Yeah. You're like, because our bodies, our existence is to be comfortable, homeostasis, right? Mm-hmm. This is where I put the physical with the mental and the behavioral. Yeah. And my social.
Trifecta.
Yeah.
So we're running up on the end of this episode, and I just wanted to give you an opportunity to answer one more poignant question, and that's, what can managers do to better support mental health in the workplace?
Or behavioral health.
Behavioral health in the workplace.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's both, right? We'll start with yourself first, you know. Practice those skills that help you to be mindful. For managers, it's having that conversation and noticing when someone's angry, upset. Validate it, but don't give into it. Mm-hmm. Because really, our ultimate goal is to problem solve. Mm-hmm. And do not give in to someone's tantrum. Do not give in to somebody's tears. Do not give in to somebody's frustrations. Acknowledge that they're going through a tough time because they're not adapting. I usually look at people like they're 2 years old, like having a tantrum. They're having a tantrum. Like they're having internal conflict. Yeah. Same with interpersonal. You know, you just say, this is inexcusable. We're not going to do this. I know you guys are both upset with each other, but we got to problem solve. We got to work with. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is, managers can be the number one stressor for people in their workplaces. You know, how much decisional latitude do you give people? You know, how do you skill them up without fearing that they're gonna leave? You can't do that. You have to realize that your folks, like, your job is to help them evolve. That's my wonderful word.
I love that.
We have to evolve. If we don't, we're going to stagnate.
Die like the dinosaurs.
Die.
Exactly. Now you said you had a book recommendation for our listeners.
Oh, yeah. This was an oldie. It's called The Happiness Hypothesis.
Oh.
And it goes through some age-old theories, not theories, but ways of living, like from Socrates to, like, you know, the yogis and to Confucius. And he translates it in, like, what helps people be happy. Because the other thing that I didn't mention was there are a lot of people doing very well, have everything they've always desired, and they're still unhappy or depressed, like clinically depressed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there's some bigger questions that need to be answered. So it's a great book. It's by Jonathan Haidt. And he's a social psychologist, studies like how we engage with each other socially and how that affects one's well-being. So I think at the workplace, we got to strive for what's called mental well-being.
Yes.
Okay.
I love that.
That's a great note to end on.
It really is. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today. I could not be more appreciative. You've brought so much great insight to our audience here, and we're really appreciative of that. And with that, Hank, would you mind closing us out?
How can people find Michelle?
Oh, good point.
My website, the usual W's, and then New Frontiers. Make sure you spell that correctly. BH.com.
Awesome.
Great.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah, awesome.
Definitely.
Thank you so much.
Thank
and on
you.
LinkedIn and, you know, other places like that.
That's awesome. Well, until next time.
I'm Wesley.
I'm Patrick.
I'm Allie.
Keep exploring, keep learning, and keep your passion for management ignited. Stay curious, stay inspired, stay mindful, and join us again next time as we help you make management make sense.